Hi, I'm Mark Anielski, your host of an Economy of Well-Being podcast. My next guest is Yasushi Oki. Yasushi is the executive director of an organization called Green Violin. Yasushi was raised in Edmonton and has called it his home since completing degrees in civil engineering at the University of Alberta and a degree in architecture at the University of British Columbia. For over 22 years, Yasushi has worked in the land development industry, including greenfield development, infill residential construction, and project management. He has spent a good portion of his professional life in civil service, including Strathcona County's current planning department, and then the Government of Alberta's Ministry of Infrastructure, and finally the City of Edmonton's Housing and Homelessness section. In his most recent nonprofit role, he served as Director of Housing at Homeward Trust in Edmonton, an organization that is focused on homelessness and serving those most in need. Yasushi brings to his work a love of urban design and a keen eye for how people interact with architecture, combined with a sensitivity to the realities of building construction and maintenance. He continues his work in community development with the establishment of a trio of sustainability-oriented organizations. First, the Green Violin Community Development Company. Second, the Rose Cello Affordable Housing Society. And third, the Prairie Sky Property Management Corporation. You could tell Yasushi likes stringed instruments. He says, "I'm all about caring and sharing. I love the Indigenous philosophy of one bowl and one spoon. And I too want to make sure that everybody has enough to eat, and that we don't take more than our share, both from nature and from each other." Yasushi is a friend, neighbor, and I'm also quite engaged myself with his Green Violin initiative. We talk about his amazing vision for affordable housing, a creative way of investing in our neighborhoods and our communities by keeping our money local and helping our neighbors in their aspirations for a better quality of life and well-being. Hope you enjoy the conversation with Yasushi Oki. Thanks for listening. So welcome, Yasushi Oki, to the Economy Wellbeing Podcast. I think you're my 79th guest, or closing on an 80 in 2 years. And you're an Edmontonian. You have Japanese roots, and you're involved in some amazing projects. Green Violin, just one of many, on some very creative ways of providing affordable housing to those most in need. And we've known each other for quite a while. And so like to know a little bit about your background. I think you have an architectural background, but you're a developer. You're actually one of those hard-nosed real estate or land developers, but you have a heart, and you often bring me Portuguese tarts, which are my favorite. And so welcome, Yasushi, to this wide-ranging conversation. So tell us a bit about yourself and the projects you're working on, which are, I find, quite compelling and exciting as a new model for affordable housing.
Wow, Mark, I'm so happy to be here. And, you know, as always, our conversations are going to take us to very exciting places. So I'm really looking forward to where this next little bit is going to go. But where I came from, civil engineering at the U of A. I went to school here in Edmonton. I grew up in Edmonton. I call it my hometown. And after a civil engineering degree, I got an architecture degree and came back to Edmonton, where I was picked up, like you said, in the land development industry, which I would call a career of providing subdivisions and housing. Though recently, with jobs I've taken at the City of Edmonton and then at Homeward Trust, I'm really impressed with, or it's impressed upon me, the need for more housing affordability. And in the last year and a half since I started up Green Violin, I've really evolved my way of thinking that it's not just housing affordability that I'm concerned with, but it's also housing sustainability. You know, how does it affect our planet, our economy? Mm. How do communities thrive around different types of urban design decisions that we make? And how do we affect our future with the whole infill conversation and the growth of Edmonton? It's a super exciting place to be in. And I'm glad I'm in the infill side as opposed to the raw land development side now, because as a crossover, I can take my skills in one area and apply it into my own backyard neighborhood, as it were.
Wow. So tell us more about the project you're working on, Green Violin, which I've been a part of as well, indirectly and indirectly. But and tell us what's so unique about what you're doing and your creative thought process and how you're delivering for or trying to develop a different model for affordable housing, and particularly from an investment side, which often is the big issue. Where's the money going to come from? And I think you've come up with some very creative ways of investment opportunities for small investors like ourselves in the local community.
Wow, Mark, your question is touching on so many different parts that I'm excited about. As always, our conversations are going to go all over the place. But what I'm trying to do here with infill development, and what I noticed as a developer and also working at the city, is there's a lot of need to have conversations with the neighbors and the community. One of the big opportunities here are to go into a neighborhood early and really see what the neighborhood, the community, and that area of the city is wanting. And not trying to push a product that isn't really the type of housing or the type of spaces that are either fitting or wanted in that community. So the Green Violin way, as I call it, is to enter into a community as a neighbor. So I'm focused entirely in my own backyard, which is the Alberta Avenue area, south of the Yellowhead, and on one side, Blatchford, on the other side, Exhibition Lands, and then going right to the downtown. So by focusing in on critical needs in that area, by being a neighbor and listening and connecting with the leaders and the community leagues that are already established there, I'm finding out so much more about what it is to be an infill developer than if I just came in with my idea and my stats on what I think the neighborhoods need. So that to me, my own development as a developer is has been really exciting, because I kind of seen myself growing into more of a community developer as opposed to a housing developer.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And then to get these projects kickstarted, Green Violin is in a stage that I call prototyping and innovating. So each of the product lines has a boundary that I'm pushing, whether it's zoning or density or community engagement, or as you just touched on, investment and financing. How do we purchase these parcels that are out there? For instance, the city has a derelict house grant out there right now, but how do we purchase and how do we find properties? And one way is, from my experience as a realtor as well, short-lived though, is that there's a lot of land out there. We just need to find the resources to pool together funds to purchase these lands. So what you've experienced as an investor in Green Violin, and what I'm expanding on, is getting small investor groups together to purchase raw land so that we can at least get a jump into the world of infill development. One area that it's evolved into is the community investment co-op concept.
Wow. So I know I keep saying wow. That's a terrible, terrible word.
He's like, no, it's not terrible.
I'm at loss. I'm at loss of words. Which, no, I'm not. But so without divulging our trade secrets, which I think the approach that you've taken is fascinating, because we have a history of the REITs, you know, the real estate investment trusts, and we know what happened with trusts, and some of them were, you know, they kind of got out of control, and we had, you know, clamped down by financial authorities on some of those instruments. Why do you think your approach, and oftentimes you'd heard it say, well, anything, you know, the lawyers might say anything less than $50,000 individual investment is just not worthwhile. It's like it's too costly to have a model where your minimum entry might be, you know, $1,000 or $5,000 for a unit. But to me, it's a compelling idea that instead of our money leaving to Bay Street or to the casino, in which we have no relationship at all with many of these stocks that we hold in our portfolio, that we can literally see our money locally invested, and not to gouge our neighbors, but actually to enable and provide the kind of the oxygen, the the financing, which is always people, where's the money going to come from? Well, actually, the money comes from me. And instead of my TFSA going to Bay Street, it's going to go into a affordable housing development in Edmonton. And I get to actually go and see it and shake the hands of the people who are living there and see the joy in their face, I hope, and maybe even measure and verify their well-being. So, you know, tell us why, like what was the kind of brainchild or the kind of the brain, the thought bubble that came to you that said, I know this is a really interesting kind of cooperative asset, shared asset model that I think could work. And a lot of people are saying, no, it's not. Let's see if this actually works. So why do you think it's going to work?
Well, I think it's going to work for many reasons, but fundamentally, buy low, sell high is what it is. Yeah. And in land development, we buy low, add value, and then sell it higher. The way it relates here is when we buy a piece of land and we rezone for density or we make improvements on it, like put on an apartment, the market value goes up. And that's what we're capturing here by pooling investors at the front end, adding value through green violins developments, and then being able to pay back the investor through the increased value of that entire property.
The entire property. So tell us one thing we found, you and I, in examining, for example, how does the bare land, the actual property itself get valued by the city or by the tax authority? And I think the answer to that is perplexing because there's no clear algorithm in my mind that defines how the bare land, the land without a home on it, is actually valued. Now, I understand when you put something on this bare land, whether it's a barn or a $250,000 stick frame house, then the overall value, I think the utility, as economists say, of the property has gone up because now you can actually use this structure for something. So the land, which was bare, had nothing on it, now has value. But how is it that it's so interesting that, so that's kind of the game that land developers play, you're saying that has always been the game. So as soon as I put something on it, if I put a condo on this, what was a farmland, now it's gone up by whatever the market decides is the value of a condo on this piece of, and it might be class one agricultural land, might be fantastic land for growing food, but it has actually have more value because it's a condo.
Yeah, that's one of the books that a boss of mine gave me to read was called Buy It by the Acre, Sell It by the Foot. And that is, you know, a lot of what you're saying, buy the farmland in volume and then add value and parse it out as valuable frontage. That concept really works. And then you touch upon a few interesting points here. How do you value the land? Like, yes, it might be zoned for an apartment, but it might sit in a neighborhood of single family houses still. Like, is really an apartment the way to value that piece of land? And then you mentioned the utility of a house sitting on a property. What's the utility of a 100-year-old house? I mean, if it's still servicing a happy family in there, does it not have value? What is the whole thing about land value only? You know, no, there's still a house on it. You know, people can live in it. And maybe there's another 50 years left in that house. So then what does that property value become? A really interesting question. Green Violin's trying to tackle it by looking at market escalation of land values, especially around TOD or LRT stations. And how do we keep affordability in the equation, even as land values escalate all around? And being from the development industry, I know that there are ways that we can get out of that competition for land, land trusts, maybe leases on government lands, government-owned lands that are given to up for the purpose of affordable housing. It does not have to be privately owned all the time in order for it to be considered housing. So there's a lot of interesting players and ideas that we can put forward here for the future of our, gosh, the city plan is looking at doubling Edmonton's population. So infill and solutions on how we get there are really intriguing and exciting for me to explore.
Excellent. So can we shift to one of my areas of inquiry with architectural and the construction world is well-being by design. The notion that we can build and we can build structures or interior space and design with kind of a well-being impact in mind, and actually measure that well-being impact, even if it's subjective, right? And so it's one thing I've been fascinated by some conversations with some construction firms, Clark Builders, and also the Winnipeg Qualico, and also companies in Singapore talking about this idea. So you and I have talked about this. What, how do you see well-being kind of fitting into the Green Violin projects? Not to like sell the well-being per se, but it's an intriguing thing. And you've seen the work that I did for Capital Region Housing Corporation and for Habitat for Humanity. So we can actually measure the well-being impacts as experienced by the beneficiaries of these affordable housing projects. It's not impossible to do. What are your thoughts about the incorporation of well-being analytics and performance measures, let's say, in
this project? It's a great question, because whereas a year and a half ago, I started off by saying that Green Violin builds affordable housing, today I say we are in the business of neighborhood well-being. And the fact that your well-being index can start to put some numbers to it is going to be fantastic. We're able to demonstrate that the projects that Green Violin builds actually do affect well-being in a positive way. But a simple example of well-being in architecture is Christopher Alexander wrote an amazing book called The Pattern Language.
Yes, I have a copy.
I think I see it right behind you there. Just kidding.
It's actually right over there. I've cracked it only a few times. Actually, it's one of those books. You just open it up and like, oh, I'm looking at a balcony in Paris. And he's talking about why this balcony is such an innovation. And
yes, you know exactly what I mean then. My favorite is window on two sides, like just to have a room with a window. And that contributes to the well-being of the occupant of that room in such a big way.
Big.
It's like you wake up every morning, or you get a cross breeze, or, you know, you watch the sunset. It's like really impacts your sense of well-being just by a simple design move of an architect adding a window at the pre-construction stage of the development. If we can take that same emotion and capture it in a neighborhood or an apartment project for the street, wouldn't that be amazing? Just, you know, a quick brushstroke at the very beginning can impact how people experience the street and how they exit their front door and happily walk down the street to either the cafe or the pocket park that's been provided there. That, to me, I think, is the goal of what Green Violin is trying to do. We're not in the business of housing. We're in the business of that whole well-being concept.
Very good. Very good. So Green Violin, what's in the word? What's in the name?
I'm glad you asked. For me, because I was looking at housing as a fundamental need, and without housing, how desperate the situation can become. And in times of desperation, I've seen that music, especially the violin, the solo violin sound, can be inspirational, it can be comforting, it can be a source of strength so that you can persevere and continue on. So to me, the violin became a symbol of hope. But then also the violin can be incorporated into a much larger symphony with many more instruments. And to me, that's the destination of my infill aspirations, is to get to the place where the violin is just a part of the fabric of the neighborhood and plays in this orchestral music that is, you know, soul enriching and very fulfilling. So to me, the violin is the perfect symbol of starting with housing, but ending up with neighborhood. And green, well, it's because we live on one planet. It's our only home and we have to take care of it. So it's a reminder for sustainable, earth-friendly construction in everything I do.
Wow. That's awesome. I think I remember that movie. What was it in Bosnia or whatever? Remember, or was it the Sarajevo, right?
The cellist of
Sarajevo, right?
Exactly.
Like Yo-Yo Ma, but you're right. That one beautiful, yeah, Just one.
Well, there's also the exhibition of Violins of the Holocaust.
Yeah.
It's just an amazing display of violins that were used to keep people together and keep people hopeful in most desperate of times.
Right. So tell us more about, I studied the Habitat for Humanity, zero interest or no interest home equity, home mortgage model. What's your operating kind of model or thoughts on green violins, real estate or affordable housing? How do you imagine operating on what basis?
Well, it's fantastic. And I'm going to touch on an earlier question that you asked about community financing and small investors. But and I'll come back to your question on how to go about operating. And I love being a nonprofit because without that profit line to keep an eye on, it's just maintenance operation, and it really simplifies the equation and allows for more creative ways of balancing the performas. But getting back to the original investor question that you had, I just thought, wouldn't it be wonderful, not just that the community is contributing to assets in its own neighborhood, but instead of the interest going into the pockets of the banks, it comes back to the people. I mean, both the capital and the interest payments, the principal and interest payments come back to the people so that then they can reinvest again. I mean, how wonderful is that, that local loop of financing? And it doesn't take that much to get going. I mean, if you consider infill lot to be under 200,000, and we can certainly go shopping in that price range, then it becomes a manageable thing for communities to invest in this property. And again, with the finished product being valued so much more and a takeout mortgage being able to provide the long-term financing, we're able to pay back the investor and the construction loans and the operating costs for Green Violin and still keep those payments low and affordable for future tenants in the building.
Wow.
Especially because, going back to your question that started this, the operating model doesn't have a profit line in it. We're at a net zero operating balancing equation. So it's quite exciting. Again, innovation and prototyping stage, we're going to prove that it can be done. And then we're just going to replicate in what I call phase two of Green Violin, which is ramping up to make a difference.
Wow. So are you borrowing any lessons from Habitat for Humanity and specifically Edmonton in your model?
Oh, absolutely. I love their mortgage geared to income concept. And the wise words of people who have been in Habitat for Humanity is not to do zero interest.
Right, right.
Have enough to cover the operating, the maintenance, and have that emergency fund set up as well. But we can include all of that and still have so much better opportunities than going towards institutional financing or traditional bank financing. And the reason is, with our nonprofit, I'm able to get much longer mortgage terms, like 40-year mortgages, which really cuts down on the annual interest payments that have to be made. And right. That's through CMHC's LMI, loan mortgage insurance.
So I think that's a really important point, which is what I discovered in studying Habitat model. I mean, mm-hmm. I think the notion of zero interest is a bit of a red herring and even irritates people, especially, even those in the virtuous social enterprise fund who might say, don't call it zero interest, because it's not really, we're not charging interest to the tenants, but we are recovering our operating costs, which we have to. We're running an enterprise. You know, you've got tenants and they have needs, and you've got an office to run. You know, and that's been my point about banking, is there actually technically is no need to charge interest on the loans, the extent that you recover those costs through other means, right? Through some call it loan fees, or if you're a cooperative, a credit union, you capture it through membership fees, right? So, and you do the math, it absolutely does work. It's not, people say, well, that how can you do without charging interest? I said, well, it's call it something else then, but it's not, you know, you you've created the money out of thin air in the first place as the bank, and then you can then still expect interest on top of the principal in which you just created as a ledger entry. And I think what Habitat's shown is they're effectively doing the same thing. I mean, they're using money that's coming in from governments and grants and maybe getting the land for free and then passing that benefit to the tenant, which is in a $40,000, say, household income scenario, which is low income. And that person, the mortgage is custom built for that income bracket. And they, you know, they'll never pay more than 30% of their income on the home. But the best part is they're actually building equity. It's not just a rent check. Do you imagine a sort of a combination of rent and equity kind of for different tenants? What's your kind of idea?
Oh, it's definitely looking at some sort of mixed market model where higher renters subsidize lower rent. And I can do that again as a nonprofit because I don't have that profit line that I'm trying to squeeze the maximum out of this building on. But also looking at co-ops right now as co-ownership and co-risk takers in developments. And this kind of segues into a conversation I had with a Muslim community leader and not being allowed to charge interest. So that there
Sharia,
must be,
right?
Yeah, absolutely. The reciprocal risk concept. And really that blends in with another culture. I was looking at doing land acknowledgements for Green Violin, and I came across the story of One Bowl, One Spoon. And one of the tenets of that is to make sure that you only take your share and everybody has enough to eat. And if we take that concept into housing and how we build and we operate housing, then it's really intriguing. As long as I have enough to eat and I make sure that they have enough to eat, then what is with regular interest? What is with you know, regular payment? And why not try and build well-being outside of the whole monthly payment construct and the stresses and the pressures? And if we can balance, like I said, the mixed market model where we balance higher rents with lower rents, those that are able to pay and those that are not able to pay, and just blend it into a non-conversation. Like, why do we focus in on affordability when we should be looking at inclusivity? Why are we looking at who gets to come in when we're looking at the city as a whole and its well-being? So, and that's why I love your whole well-being index survey and the efforts in measuring, because then we're able to see what else is. What? That's the question I asked myself. And I realized after housing, then it's neighborhood and community. We're social. We need that.
And it's the broader, you know, community asset model that John McKnight and Peter Block and our friend Howard Lawrence here in Edmonton has been leading inside the city. So that notion of shared community assets is so exciting. I mean, that's the next frontier. So not only can we imagine a shared neighborhood investment trust where we literally owning shares in our neighbor's property. And when we have excess residual, like even my accountant yesterday, I had my year end. He said, you know, well, maybe you'll never retire. Maybe you'll shift from well-being economics to investment. Because I was telling about Green Violin and he goes, and he's a developer too. He does housing, like, what do you call them? Modular housing. And you know, another subject we can talk about is the First Nations, you know, the relationship with First Nations, and I know you've got some really innovative model there of saying inviting an elder to be a maybe a co-steward of a unit, a live-in elder that gets free rent because their service to, you know, their maybe some Indigenous, but the service to others is actually a benefit of well-being. But it's recognized in the form of subsidized or no rent. But, you know, you can do the math on the back end and say, you know, that if that two people in that unit are now mentally happier, right? They're out of poverty. They're not a line item in the city's budget, like $150,000 for a homeless person. That should be recognized as a value of that elder being in that unit. And yeah.
How do you put a dollar amount to it? You're absolutely right. And you touch upon one of the green violin ways is to remain in the community after the development has been completed. And one way we do that is to retain a unit within our apartments, and we place, exactly like you said, a peer of the community as well as a peer of the tenant in that unit. What could be called a block connector under the abundant community program, or what could be called the community concierge, but somebody who takes a pulse check, maybe perhaps through your well-being index, of the residents of the of not only the apartment, but also of the community, and does interventions, does introductions of people to activities on Alberta Avenue, for instance, the Deep Freeze Festival or the community garden, or just, you know, does that small mental check-in with the tenant down the hall that needs that extra word of comfort in order to get them through, you know, in a dark hour, or not tip into the over the cusp of, you know, civil disruption. It's
right,
those
right.
little things that you talk about that, how do you put a dollar value to the service that somebody does to keep somebody else happy? It's a great question that you're asking.
So another subject that I find intriguing, and one thing that, you know, working, having been invited to Cincinnati to have similar discussions on, you know, not just, it was called the Jubilee Project, and the housing project was called the Jubilee Housing Project, which was to restore distressed homes or derelict homes in Cincinnati, which were boarded up, and the city couldn't even afford to bulldoze them. So the city is willing to sell that property and the house for $1,000. To a young minister named Thomas Hargis, who is a Methodist minister who studied Habitat's model and is also a former prison warden in New Orleans. So he came up with this crazy idea of, you know, getting those, buying the property for $1,000, going to Home Depot and Lowe's and getting all of these, you know, first of all, doing an assessment of the home, is it structurally sound, right? And it might be full of pigeons and everything, but, you know, then hiring halfway house guys that are coming out of prison, paying them cash every 2 weeks, restoring that home for about $35,000 in materials, and often reused or secondhand, you know, discounted materials from the Home Depot. So having those guys develop a skill, and in three projects, they're ready to move down to Louisville, Kentucky, or whatever, and make $40 an hour, not $20, right? Mm-hmm. All this on this idea that, similar to what you're doing, is saying now the low-income household can move in, be basically debt-free, have a mortgage based on their income, but the valuation of the home is now, you know, the average house in Cincinnati is $150,000. So there be on the books, you're able to put that on the books for say even $40,000, okay? Because it's what it costs you to pay the guys, buy the materials, right? And now you can design the mortgage to be based on what valuation. You can decide what valuation. Now the assets are sitting inside this trust fund, which is, of course, holding the asset, which becomes a collateral grade asset, right? And I was thinking about it even further. It's like, wait a minute, if that young African-American household is debt-free in 10 years, because that's all it would take at even a valuation of $70,000, a mortgage based on that valuation, which is half the market value, leaves them debt-free in 10 years. Wow. So they would have never been able to, that would have never happened. They might now send their kids to school. They can maybe borrow from the trust to send their kids to college. But the home itself is retained in the fund as an annuity, right? As a source of an annuity, which I believe is what Singapore has been doing with their public housing trusts. So these are things that I'd like to throw at you and say, well, okay, we couldn't quite like execute it in Cincinnati. And there are many reasons for that. There's always barriers to entry, and they're not because the ideas aren't good. They're oftentimes because there's vested interest in keeping the status quo. So your thoughts about this idea of making these community assets the basis of potentially annuity. Because I think the real estate portfolio is the biggest piece of any community trust kind of structure.
Oh, absolutely. I'll I'll do an example of a tiny home community that we're chasing right now, and it's going to be a cooperative ownership model. But exactly like you say, once the financing is paid off in 7 years, then they're sitting on, the co-op is sitting on an asset that's worth way more than what it took to get it up and going in the first place. Yeah. And can you imagine if they could borrow against that and then create yet another community, like kickstart another one, and you can get this kind of this, the whole domino effect of community improvement just by leveraging those small moves up front. And if we can do it across many different neighborhoods, then it's going to be like this a momentum that's built up in being able to have, and this is all money owned by the community and all assets that are retained in the community. It's an amazing idea, and I'm so excited to demonstrate it through our first tiny home community.
It's so exciting to see it happening in Edmonton. I don't have to fly to Cincinnati, and I can't anyway. So, but I'm going to use a Japanese word here. You're creating a tsunami. Yeah,
getting the traction. What a journey of 1,000 leagues that starts with the first step. That sort of idea.
So tell me, there's always barriers. There's always, heartache and resistance to change. We know that. What are you experiencing, and are you yielding and prevailing in the Taoist mastery of, or the Aikido master, or the samurai, or are you almost having like, as if there's no fence? What are you experiencing in terms of the journey?
Oh, the journey is fantastic. I feel like, though, I'm keeping under the radar. It's almost as if, you know how you can find peace and interesting things under the stadium seats where there's all the scaffolding. It feels like that is very
I remember those days. That's right. You're like,
yeah. And, there's all the regulation happening up top and all the noise. But down here, this is where the support system is actually at. And you can see many people, and there's a lot more freedom to move around and be creative down here. And then when you actually do emerge from the stands, and then you've got the strength and the experience and the proven projects to support these new ideas that didn't have to go through the noise and the opposition of those that are in the establishment. So I'm really excited about being nimble, of being able to test ideas, and not having a huge infrastructure to have to be to have to address and drag me down. And it's actually through thinkers like yourself, supporters and advocates that have really helped me come up with these ideas. So I'm nothing without the support of people like yourself. And I really appreciate all the ideas that are coming forward and all the support I'm getting on moving forward with new ideas and new ways of housing. And when I say new, I mean new to Edmonton's conventional ways of doing things. Really, there's nothing new under the sun.
Yeah, there's nothing new. But to me, as a guy that, thought I was smart as an economist, thought I would know how to invest wisely in the stock market. I'm like, I may as well throw darts, but in your enterprise, I'm not just throwing darts. I'm throwing darts with such precision, such verifiable impact. We talk about impact investment. We don't even know how to measure impact. And yet I'm seeing a opportunity here to not only invest wisely, but to get returns that are not just good for my own financial well-being, but are clearly impacting somebody's quality of life that I can literally, and what a beautiful, and happiness is about relationships. So what you're doing is like, it's so spectacular. But I do wonder, like, the cynical side of me says, what they call it, windfall profits, right? That the early adopters in Green Violin were like, I'm not even going to talk about what kind of returns you might suggest are possible, but I put it this way. Even if I make 2% on my investment, it's better than sitting even in the public bank called ATB, because it's doing nothing there and literally nothing. And so at least in this case, I'm building an investment portfolio that has returns that are reasonable. I'm not gouging. I know I could probably charge even, you know this, and we know this, we could charge even more on the rent, but we don't have to. We can make it a perfect kind of market rate too.
Exactly. As long as
yeah.
long as we all have enough to eat.
So do you, but on this kind of cynical question of, do you think at some point, let's say the city goes, it was like saying to Cincinnati, well, you know, you go to the city mayor, you say, I know a third of the houses are boarded up. It looks like Detroit, actually not quite as bad, but, you know, and so, you know, I remember talking to Thomas Hargis about this. I said, how many homes can you do a year? He said, maybe 20, because that's all the energy has, right? And, you know, so at some point you kind of run out of, you don't have enough energy to do all of that you could do. But do you think the city in some way might go look at you, go like, we know that you are benefiting a few savvy eminent investors with these windfall profits on properties we've sold you, Yusushi, on the premise that yes, you're building affordable housing, but again, it goes to the cynicism about developers are winning again. See, they get all the money because they had this, I don't know, this smarts, or what do you say to that kind of
that is a great question, Mark, and it's because time and again, as I buy city land, I can't negotiate a better deal than what they're willing to say is market value for the land. It's frustrating for me, but your point, if anybody ever asks, I'm able to say I'm paying market land values here.
Because the seller is defined. I don't care who the seller is, whether it's a city, they've defined the algorithm in which the valuation is made. Mm-hmm. So who are you going to complain? If they complain, they can only look at themselves in the mirror going, wow, Yusushi just made off with like millions, and we clearly undervalued the property because we didn't realize the uplift value of what he was doing.
Oh, it's absolutely true. And I'll give you an example. It's going to be a great example, but the Parkdale lot that we just purchased, full market value from the city's perspective, put together an investor group, purchased the land. The investors can now walk on it. We are putting a community garden on there. We're putting a COVID-friendly seating area, temporary uses until the apartment actually gets there, and then continuing the community garden after the apartment is up as well. But that community garden now has an indigenous portion where there's going to be a learning and teaching of medicinal herbs and traditional plants alongside the other gardeners that are part of the community. And now for an investor to be able to walk through and say, my money was able to buy this kind of community activity. We're not even talking about the apartment yet. We're just talking about space where people can gather and grow things and share stories. And then, then you get the pleasure of building the apartment and then having these community members already familiar with gathering on that land and then now interacting with the tenants. So they're not strangers anymore. Wow. They're really welcomed into the fabric of the community. And this is what the investors' dollars are doing, is keeping it local and providing an opportunity to create spaces.
Wow. Well, I still have to come and visit the Parkdale now that it's spring, Edmonton. So, before we conclude, so walk me through like the most likely scenario from, you know, land purchase to actually occupancy. Like, what do you think is your reasonable timeline on, say, the Parkdale project or any future projects? I mean, and recognizing there will be hiccups, and you know, I hear that building costs have gone up. My accountant said at least 20%. Lumber, wood, everything's gone up, right? So you can't even get appliances. Like, so these are the realities of a COVID a pandemic economy. So what do you think is a reasonable kind of timeline?
We're looking at a 3-year timeline. The first year is investors and purchase of the land. A parallel effort in that first year is community conversation and being part of the neighborhood, which is going to get easier and easier as I do more projects in Alberta Avenue area, because I've already established these relationships. It's just a matter of identifying new opportunities and new needs that the community has for future projects. But this particular one, year one is getting the land together, having the community conversation, and getting the project design underway so that in year two, we've got that construction underway. And to touch on construction, we haven't even discussed modular or mass timber or passive
house or tiny house or other things
that we're pursuing here. But
that'll be for our next conversation. Like when you.
Oh yeah, I think so. It's so exciting to talk about the community side of Green Violin, that there's a whole technology and construction management. And when I say construction management, I mean modular, I mean panelization, I mean factory, all the ways of getting efficiencies up and reducing waste and getting costs down. So to answer your question, that's how we do it in the second year. And then the third year, when we're doing occupancy, when we're doing community engagement, and we're actually running the programs like social enterprises that we haven't talked about that are operating on the main floor of the apartment, where seniors are teaching the youth how to cook and life skills as they put together meal kits for the neighborhood for better and healthier meal options, where we have the youth who are students living in the apartment teaching the community children in after school tutoring, social enterprise ideas. There's a lot of ways where in that third year, we're connecting the tenants of the building with the community and improving. And it all comes down to what we started off with, that well-being of the neighborhood.
The bento box of well-being. I like it. Yeah, I can already hear it now.
Just I'm going to have to steal that phrase from you. Oh, yeah.
Well, I used to have an app called Bento Box Organizing, for the computer. And I thought, yeah, it's like the bento box.
I love it. It's the way we ensure that there's carbs, vegetables, and proteins all in a complete meal.
That's right. All complete.
I love it. Now there's earth-friendly, inclusionary, and social connectivity in an entire meal, in an entire project. That's a great way of looking at it. Thank you, Mark.
Wow. Well, Yusishi, this has been fun, highly educational, full of hope in a pandemic. We need signs of hope. And I know there's going to be more to come. I can't wait to have a conversation a year from now or 2 years to with the lived in experience and talking to some of your tenants. And...
Oh yeah. 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 Let's do a follow up here. Let's do like a year two follow up and then a year three follow up. And it'll be a great look at the progression, and it'll build up that tsunami of momentum and getting into the second stage again, ramping up to make a difference for Green Violin.
I can't tell you how many American friends who are like interested in the public banking space who want to talk to you or want to learn like what is Green Violin about, and I think it's so exciting. It's transferable, it's scalable. Absolutely, you can't say that. And as you said, it's all within the bounds of existing rules and regulations, and there's nothing revolutionary about this. This is about true community asset development. And so thank you.
Yeah, it's having the right attitude and the right people around and the right people. I think with guys like you on the team, it's like a sure thing that it's going to be a success here.
Just like honey, it'll attract a lot of us. Yeah. All the good
bears. The doors.
It's an
open source company, like I say.
It's an open source. Well, wonderful. Thank you so much for joining me. And as I was sitting here, I was like, I probably wrote 10 more people that come to mind right away. Dennis Cuckoo built the Mosaic Center, he and Christy, right? Envisioned that amazing net zero LEED certified. Doug Solos, the architect I work with, and Mike Boychuk from.
Oh, yes.
There, and I just post on my website the well-being assessment we did for the community hall in Twilliger there in Oak Hills, right? Howard Lawrence, who I've never interviewed, who's really the architect of running communities here, and just so many more people that are like, wow. Now at least I'll have 100 guests, I'm sure, by now.
Oh, totally. And I can keep adding to your guest list, but everybody that I'm starting to meet, they already know you, Mark. So it's just a matter of getting to them and getting their message through these conversations that you're making podcasts out of. I think it's brilliant what you're doing, and it really gives a wide audience for the messages that we all carry.
It really does. I mean, it's all about the positive stories, that the innovations are everywhere. And that's what I love about this podcast. And it's, there's just stories of average people doing innovative things. And, you know, I don't need famous people. I just need people like you saying, what are you doing in little old Edmonton? And, you know, U of A, mechanical engineering, mechanical, right? Mechanical engineering. Yeah.
Civil.
Civil engineering. Yeah.
Civil, wow. Structural architecture, but it's all about people, really.
And it is all about relationships and people. So thanks again, and hope you have a great day.
Oh, absolutely. Always do. I find our conversation so invigorating and refreshing. I got to thank you, Mark.
And, me too. And I can't wait for the next installment of Portuguese Charts. Tarts.
Oh, yeah.
Charts. You know, even charts.
We'll make charts while eating
tarts. We'll make charts while eating tarts.
Charts for charts.